This podcast is brought to you by Day Soul Coffee Lab out of Birmingham, Alabama. Y'all, I consider myself a coffee connoisseur. I absolutely love coffee, and I found what I believe to be the absolute best coffee out there. With Day Soul Coffee Lab, you can be sure to get coffee that's super smooth and always fresh roasted. Some of the best, if not the best coffee you'll ever drink. So swing over to the website, daysoulcoffeelab.co, and use promo code LOWDOWN to get 10% off your order. They even have a subscription option where they'll deliver coffee directly to you every month. So guys, it's a no-brainer. If you're going to drink coffee, you might as well make it great coffee. What is up, everyone? Welcome to the latest installment of the Lowdown Popcast, where we keep it popping on all of your favorite topics about real life. I am your host, Elliot Poston. You can be sure to follow this show on all social media platforms at Lowdown Popcast. Use the hashtag TLDP for anything referring to the show. And you can also follow me at the Elliot Poston. Joining me tonight is former United States Marine Corps captain, co-founder and former CEO of Lima One Capital, where he founded in 2011 and later sold in 2008 for a nice hefty price tag. He is the current CEO of a new startup known as Gem Mining. He is a former South Carolina candidate for governor and co-author of Lead Like a Marine. There's a more to that title. Lead like a Marine. Run towards a challenge. Assemble your fire team and win your next battle. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Mr. John Warren.
Thanks, Elliot. Happy to be with you.
Hey, thank you for, I'm really, really excited. Actually voted for you for governor.
Thank you.
So whenever you, said, yeah, you'd be more than happy to jump on the show. I was really thrilled. And I've kind of followed your journey and stuff over the years. I love seeing people succeed. I love learning from people who are successful. And, you've were a captain in the United States Marine Corps. You're entrepreneur. I'm from a family of entrepreneurs. I think I have some of that entrepreneurial spirit in me, possibly, but not in the realm like my dad and my brother does. But it's there, and just seeing people succeed is just always something that's very, very just intrigues me. I love hearing people's stories about how they success, what drives them, and so first, man, I just want to say again, thank you for joining us tonight. Really excited to just talk. We spoke briefly earlier today. Won't get into too much football unless it leads that way. But, before we jumped on, we were talking about NSYNC, you know.
You were talking about NSYNC.
Touche. Valid point.
I said that NSYNC was still around.
Yeah. So we're, my wife's hoping they make a reunion tour. I don't think it's happening. We'll know before the night's over, hopefully, for my sanity. But let's just jump right into it. John, tell us about you. Who is John Warren?
Well, I'll tell you one thing about your introduction when you say you like to interview successful people. You know, I think a lot of times people see the successful, quote, successful person from the outside. They see all the successes. But I can tell you, I can give you 100 stories for every success, which ended in failure. So I think it's our story. We say it in the book, you know, Lead Like a Marine's a story of perseverance and grit. and overcoming adversity, because I think regardless of who you are, life is hard.
Yeah.
Life is really hard. And oftentimes people see the successes, but man, we struggled. We had a lot of things to overcome in building that company. We had a lot of things to overcome in fighting a counterinsurgency in Iraq. And, you know, it's just about keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward.
Strap your boots, pull your bootstraps up.
Yeah.
So how long were you stationed over there?
So I went into the Marine Corps mainly because of 9/11. I was down in Myrtle Beach yesterday. I got asked to speak on 9/11. And when I was preparing for those remarks, I couldn't believe that it had been 22 years since 9/11. And when I was thinking about that, I'm like, the average age of a Marine that goes into, that signs up and enlists now is 18. Mm. So the vast majority of our military who is joining today, they weren't even born when 9/11 happened. So that was kind of shocking. But that was kind of the stimulus for me wanting to go in. Both my grandfathers had been in the Pacific in World War II, and I idolized those, both of those guys. And 9/11 happened. I felt like it was my turn to serve, and I wanted to lead Marines in combat, and I got my opportunity in March of 2006. We got to Ramadi, Iraq.
So when 9/11 happened, do you remember where you were that day?
Absolutely. Remember it just like it was yesterday. I was in college. I was a junior. I came out of a class. I had an 8 o'clock class. I came out and started checking different news sites just to see what was going on. And, you know, this is also a time where we had no smartphones, right?
So you had to
run to a computer to check your email or see what was going on. And I kept going to different sites, and they said they were overwhelmed and I couldn't get on them. And then finally I checked Drudge, and I remember Drudge had a siren going round and around, and the headline was, "We're under attack." And then the rest of the day I spent glued to a TV. One of my roommates at school, his sister was working at Merrill Lynch as an investment banker in New York. So he was very, very worried about her, couldn't get a hold of her. And I don't know, it was just a shocking, I just couldn't believe the towers came down. I couldn't believe the whole thing really transpired. But yeah, I definitely remember it.
Yeah, I'll never forget, I was in ninth grade.
Now you're making me feel old.
Well, I remember just everything stopping that day. They wouldn't dismiss us from school because there were so many unknowns.
Yeah.
But I remember just hearing, hey, a plane just ran into the Royal Train Center. I remember them pulling it up at school. And while on the TV at school, you saw the second one happen. And, and there a lot of fear that day. A lot of remorse, sympathy, empathy. Just an overwhelming range of emotions.
I think it was shocked that they could pull it off, right? I mean, we hadn't been attacked on home soil.
Exactly.
In any serious manner since, you know, December 7, 41. So I think that was a wake-up call to the country.
Well, and you look at everything that changed after that. You know, we U.S. Marshal on every airplane now. At least for, I guess it still is. you know, in the movies, you always see the guy wearing the jacket says U.S. Marshal, but on the plane, I've ridden multiple planes and never know who the marshal is, and I'm sure he's there or she's there. But man, what a change it made in America. I mean, like you said, we went to war and you served in it. So take us through that process of enlisting and moving up the ranks to where you were captain and everything.
Yeah, I'm sure you probably speak about that. I wanted I wanted to fight. I wanted to be on the ground. I wanted to lead Marines in combat. So I went to what's called an OSO, an officer selection officer, and said, hey, sign me up for OCS. And he's, you know, the weird thing about the Marine Corps is after times of war, there are tons of people trying to get in. So he said, hey, you're going to have to wait a year. And I was definitely disappointed, but ultimately said, okay, I'm willing to wait a year. And then 6 months later, he called me. He said, hey, we got a slot for you. He goes, all you got to do is pass the PFT, the physical fitness test. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's going to be easy. And I get out there and I bomb the pull-ups. So I fail the PFT. And I just felt embarrassed and just so disappointed. And then I took a fast track management position with Michelin for a year. And that entire year, all I did was work out other than work, and made a perfect score after, and went into the Marine Corps in 2004. Went to OCS for 10 weeks. We had about one third of our platoon was booted out of OCS for a variety of reasons. Then commissioned a second lieutenant, then went to 6 months of what's called the basic school of Quantico, where you're really taught to be an infantry officer at the very basics. And all of the Marine officers go there. And then from there, I went to infantry officer course for about 3 months. And I tell everyone, you know, the Marine Corps does an amazing job of training their infantry officers. I really mean that. It's unbelievable training. But they make it so utterly challenging and miserable that you cannot wait to get to combat. Combat is so much better than the infantry officer course. So I reached 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines as a 2nd Lieutenant Platoon Commander in September of 05. And the unit had just come back from Fallujah. And they were very, very seasoned, very well respected, had seen a ton of combat. And here I was, this green boot lieutenant showing up to say, hey, guys, I'm here to lead you. And did a workup with them for about 5 months. And then we deployed to Ramadi in March of 2006.
Man. So 2006, you get deployed, go to Iraq, and over there for how long?
We were in Ramadi for 7 months, and that was tough fighting. We took 18 killed in the battalion. Mm. My platoon had about one third Purple Hearts earned, but ultimately it was just a life changing experience for me. You know, a lot of people want to talk about veterans as broken or, I would say victims.
Yeah,
and they want to push the PTSD, but. And we definitely, PTSD definitely does exist, but ultimately the vast majority of us do not have PTSD. We have what's called post-traumatic growth. And we fought a very challenging counterinsurgency, but we came up with new tactics on how to do it just on the fly. And, you know, in the book, you mentioned Lead Like a Marine. The first principle we talk about is do everything for a reason. And we developed that by fighting a counterinsurgency in Ramadi. So we did a lot of crazy things over there. You know, we started talking to all the population. We did a census. We would take squads into every house in our area of operations with an interpreter. We would cut deals with the nationalists. We would pursue Al-Qaeda. We developed a ton of human intelligence. And we really just came up with a new way to do counterinsurgency, because 2006 was pre-surge. We were not, the war was not going well, and we definitely needed to change tactics. And I was fortunate enough to work for an amazing company commander and company staff that was willing to think outside the box. And by the time we left, it was a decrease of about 80% of enemy attacks against us. And about 3 months later, after 1st Battalion, 6th Marines replaced us and continued our tactics, Ramadi was totally peaceful. So, it was an amazing experience. The Marines are just incredible. I have the ultimate respect for everyone that served under me. It's unbelievable what a 18, 19-year-old Marine can do in the toughest of situations. It was very, very combat-oriented in Ramadi, but at the same time, they could flip a switch and go from handing out school supplies to attacking the enemy to flipping the switch back to being very respectful of the civilians there. So I tell everyone we killed a lot of insurgents and terrorists, but we helped thousands more of Iraqis, and I'm very proud of what we did there.
So at the end of that 7 months, did you come home then get deployed again?
Yeah, I can't. Well, I first requested to do what's called a hot rack.
Okay.
And then I felt like by the end of the 7 months, I felt like I really knew Ramadi really well. I probably knew it better than the city of Greenville, which I grew up in at that point. I knew every alleyway. I knew all the local leaders. And I requested to stay on with 1st Battalion, 6th Marines. But they said, no, 7 months was enough. So I came home, was transferred to Weapons Company, which was a promotion. But I did not want to leave my platoon and did not want to leave my company. But was moved to Weapons Company, given 81 millimeter mortars and what's called trap force, which is tactical recovery. So I was in charge of 72 Marines at that point. So it was a big promotion. But the second deployment, we worked up for another 6 months, and then we deployed in July of 2007 back to the Middle East. So, you know, it's one thing. Back then, one of the things that made it so challenging on families, luckily for me, I was single. But one of the things that makes it so challenging for the Marines and different branches is they talk about the deployments. The deployments are difficult and you're gone. But what makes it worse is when you're back, you know, you get this 2 week block time and then you go back to training, especially if you're infantry.
Yeah.
So you may be, quote, home, but you're not home. You're in the field. So, you know, just the deployment. I mean, I had Marines, they were on their fourth deployment with me in 3 years. So it's amazing what they can do. And I just give all the credit in the world to their wives and their kids who can sustain that, because it's really challenging.
Yeah, I got a good friend of mine who's who's in the Air Force, and he's part of Air Guard now, but he's stationed for 6 to 8 weeks away from his family. We're here in South Carolina, but he's in Texas right now. I believe it's because of a promotion that he actually got. And hopefully this sets up to where he's able to work with the Air Guard here at home. So,
yeah.
But,
I mean, the only thing now is, I mean, FaceTime has changed everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I mean, it's just unbelievable. My dad traveled a lot. I remember, you know, between ball games and different events, you know, if he was on the road, we would try to be home by 8:30 so that when he called the landline, we were there to answer and have a conversation. But now FaceTime changes everything. You know, you can see ball games, sporting events. You can see ballets, whatever your kids are doing. It makes it a little better, I think, compared to the way it was.
You mentioned post-traumatic growth as one of the biggest things y'all deal with. What? Tell me, when it comes to that, how did you adapt? Like, what was it that you did to adapt to? And who knows? Maybe you still deal with it some. What's some things that you did to kind of process and get back into civilian mode? How's that work out?
I mean, for me, combat was relatively easy from a mental and emotional standpoint. And so much of that, I think, dealt with, I just had unbelievable training. And then the second thing was, whatever happened, I did not want to let my Marines down. I mean, I had the ultimate respect for them and I wanted them to respect me. So one of the things we talk about is masking. So even when you're scared, you know, mask it for your Marines so they don't see it. So combat, relatively speaking, I would say was fairly easy for me in terms of mental and emotional. But coming out of the Marine Corps, I mean, that's challenging because I think one of the things, it's not a PTSD thing. You know, we have tons of suicides and that's a serious problem for veterans, but it's not due to PTSD. it's due to the Marines and the other service veterans not having any purpose anymore.
Yeah.
Because what happens is you're in the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps does an unbelievable job of making the mission and making the Corps, and, you know, really almost a borderline religion. It gives you all the purpose in your life, and you are willing to go take, you know, a machine gun bunker in at Iwo Jima. You're willing to go run into IEDs in Ramadi, Iraq, but you're doing it for a higher cause.
Yeah.
And you're buying into this belief that you're affecting national security, foreign policy, and you are. And then the challenge becomes, and you're super, super close with your buddies. I mean, an infantry platoon, an infantry squad, an infantry fire team, they are so close. I mean, like,
it's like a family.
Think how close you are to your family, and then take it to another degree, because, I mean, as close as you are to your family, you've never experienced combat with them.
Yeah.
And you just get so close to these guys, and then you come out, and all of a sudden you don't have that support network. You don't have that team. You don't have that higher calling. And then to make it worse, for the most part, I would say a lot of civilians, especially employers, they really do appreciate what you've done for the country, but they don't recognize the value that you bring to the private sector. And then you don't have a lot of opportunities to get hired and have a strong career. So I tell everyone, you know, I would love to tell everyone that, you know, I had this amazing vision to start Lima One coming out of the Marine Corps. I didn't. And the whole reason Lima One Capital exists is because no one wanted to hire me, because they thought I had no skill sets. They were like, hey, you're a politics major. You are an infantry officer. Really appreciate your service, but you don't have any industry experience.
Yeah.
So I started Lima One almost out of desperation. And I think we have proven that Marines and infantry officers and company gunnery sergeants can do really well in business. But that's really the catalyst to what started Lima One Capital.
Yeah, I hate that, you know, our servicemen and women get that stigma of, hey, you have no experience, you know, because my buddy I was talking about, he knows how to code. He does coding. I don't know how to code when it comes to computers. He knows coding. I had a cousin-in-law who, he's got his HVAC licensing and certification through the Army, and now he does that while he's still part of the National Guard, but he does that as his job, and then goes every 6 weeks or so to drill. But yeah, I hate that there's that stigma there that they don't know nothing. They're just,
well, I think employers, I mean, when I talk to businesses, one of the things I talk about is, hey, if you want a stronger workforce, hire people based on their core values and their competencies rather than their industry experience. Mm. And you will open up a world of such quality potential employees that you never had before. You know, at Lima One, we hired people from all different industries. We hired them straight from college, and we did that based on our experience in the Marine Corps. Yeah. I tell everyone, hey, do you respect the Marine Corps? Do you think they're pretty effective at fighting? And everyone says, yes. And I said, you realize that the Marine Corps hires people with no combat experience, right? They train them up. So business would learn a lot from doing and following the same example as the Marine Corps.
That's good. Yeah, it's really mind blowing, that you have to share that information. Like, you have to tell companies, hey, this is what you need to do.
It's crazy. Most corporations cannot think logically or outside the box. If you ask them, hey, why do you do this? Why, how'd you come up with these hiring practices?
Policy.
They're going to say, well, we've always done it that way.
Yeah.
Or that's the way the industry does it. Right? They can't give you a logical reason as to why they hired these people. know, we would hire underwriters. We would prefer that they had no experience in our industry. Hey, we'll take them straight from college. We'll take them straight from the military. We'll take teachers that are leaving the profession. We'll take them from all these different industries, but we don't want them from being underwriters at other large banks.
Yeah.
Because we think they've been trained wrong. Why do I want an employee that's been at 9 companies in 11 years, even though they're, quote, an underwriter? You know, I'd rather have someone straight from the military who I can train and trust, who's a hard worker and high integrity, and I'll train them up and they'll be with me forever.
That's good. Yeah, it's you can always train somebody, but it's hard to untrain somebody.
Exactly.
And I'm with you on that. You know, when it comes to people trying to get into a new industry, yeah, you know, there's certain things when it comes to experience or leadership that I think trumps a degree. You know, someone with 10 to 15 years of experience in a service industry, no matter what the service industry is, if they've got that experience, I don't think they don't necessarily need a degree in business.
One of the critiques of our company early on from some of the large hedge funds when we were really trying to grow, you know, my COO, who is the co-author of the book with me, he was a 22-year retired master sergeant with 9 deployments, 5 combat deployments, decorated multiple times for valor, ran schools such as the entire School of Infantry for the Marine Corps. And some of these hedge funds said, we have concerns because he doesn't have a college degree. And I'm like, you know, guys, you got to think a little outside the box here. What he has, I mean, that's one, and
that's experience. You can't
probably 1 out of 100 million have. And you're talking about a college degree, which anyone can go and get. So yeah. It was interesting to see some of the institutional capital, some of their perceptions of these different things.
I would much prefer someone's experience over a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So you've hit on do everything for a reason earlier, right? I want to try kind of look getting back into some of these 9 key strategies for Marine leadership that you talk about in your book. You have do everything for a reason, build a team of killers. That intrigues me. Train for culture first.
That was one of the pushbacks from our publisher. They're like, hey, we may need to change the title of that.
Oh, no.
we can explain what killers are and what we mean by that. We're talking about killer achievers, killer performers, people with killer integrity. But, you know, I don't use anything more positively to describe some of my team members than killers. We got to keep that in there.
Yeah. And I guess it's one of those things that I'll text friends of mine, like especially team members at church. They did great on Sunday. Hey man, you killed it today. I mean, they didn't get an axe to somebody, you know?
Yeah.
I love that. Train for culture first. Empower your fire teams. Be blunt and direct. Like that one. Enforce up or out. Let's touch on that one. Enforce up or out.
Well, I mean, I think for us, that's probably the shortest chapter. But in the Marine Corps, if you're not progressing up the chain of command, you're out. They'll just kick you out. So they're not going to let you stay a corporal for 10 years. And what we meant by that up or out, you know, we had a pure meritocracy at Lima One Capital. And we would try to bring in who we called killers. A players love to be around A players. They hate to be around B players.
Yep.
They despise C players, right? So an A player to us was someone that had just unbelievable grit, incredible work ethic, high integrity. They were a team player. And they really had just a little bit of a chip on their shoulder because they had something to prove.
Yeah.
So we would try to bring those people in. And ultimately, you know, our turnover rate at Lima One was almost non-existent. we did not even lose anyone on the management team the entire time I was there. So for us, up or out means, hey, get the right players on the bus. And once you determine someone's the wrong player, get them off the bus immediately. Well, like, there's no question. And one of the things that we say in the book is, if you want to know if you should have this person on your team, just ask the question, do you want them on the team? Would you rehire them? Would you ask them to be on the team now, knowing what you know? And if you would say, hey, based on what I know now, I would never have hired this guy, then they shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And those are hard conversations to have, but ultimately I've never regretted firing someone too early. I've definitely regretted firing people too late.
Yeah. Well, and it's amazing though also that whenever someone is working and they feel like they're working with a purpose, it's amazing how much better their, what's the word I'm looking for? Performance is.
We interviewed over 40 of our employees for the book, just for some color, some good quotes, and some background for Lima One. We doubled every single year. Now, that's very, very rare. We doubled in size every single year. And one of the questions we asked all of our employees was, hey, what are you most proud of at Lima One Capital? And I expected every single person to say, we doubled every single year. And not one of them said that. They all said, we are so proud of the culture. We're so proud of the integrity. We're so proud of the blunt and direct communication. Not one of them talked about the growth. They said growth was a result of that.
Yeah.
But everyone was about the core values. And that was one of the most important things that I actually learned in writing the book was just, I mean, I always knew core values was really important. I'm not sure I realized that everyone else in our organization believed the same thing, but now I am convinced everything comes down to core values.
Well, and it sets the culture that you're trying to achieve. You know, and if when you have purpose, it gives you something to point your target at or point your arrow at to shoot towards.
Yeah.
And I see that so much in the in today's culture and society is that people really struggle with purpose. And now I hate to see that because, you know, being a Christian and stuff, the fact that I have breath in my lungs means I have purpose. Sometimes we may struggle with what that is. But, you know, man, it eats me up inside just for people just not even realize that they have purpose.
I'm doing a Bible study right now. So it's like 9 of us. We're reading through the Bible chronologically. I think it's 87 weeks. So it ends up being about 14 chapters a week. But right now we're in Ecclesiastes. And one of the things that stuck out to me this week was there's a quote in there from Solomon because he wrote it, saying everything under the sun is vain. It's nothing but vanity. It means nothing. And he wasn't saying everything on, you know, on earth is vain. What he's saying is if you're looking at your purpose from a earthly perspective, you're not going to find any fulfillment.
Yeah.
I really believe, you know, you got to look above the sun, like Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, to find real purpose.
You know, it's funny because I mentioned to you earlier that I've started trying to pursue music more. And I had a conversation with someone the other day. Well, I've had several conversations, but one thing that I've learned is my purpose is to entertain people as well as lead worship. And someone said, well, aren't they the same? I said, no. Completely different. One, there's a weight that I feel when I lead worship, and it's not a bad weight. I actually enjoy it because it's a weight that for me, God's saying, "Hey, what Luke says, to whom much is given, much is required. Hey, I gave you this gift. I'm holding you responsible and accountable at a high standard. Achieve it. Do it. And then, you know, how do we do that? Well, we trust in the Lord with all our heart and lean not on our own understanding, but acknowledge him for who he is, and he will direct our paths. So, and, you know, I wear Colossians 3:23 on my right arm, which is whatever you do, work at with all your heart. It's work for the Lord, not for men. And I was having a conversation with someone earlier today about how for so long I strive for perfection, right? And up until 5 years ago, my mind shifted. And I went from trying to be perfect or striving for perfection to pursuing excellence. And I think for me, that allows me to have bigger vision. And it also allows me to get better every day. And what I mean by that is, and maybe you can relate, whenever I would try and do everything perfect, I messed up all the time. By messing up all the time, because I'm human, because I'm of a sinful nature, and because I'm only made perfect through the blood of Jesus, I would still beat myself up over that. But the moment that one of my pastors said, hey, you know, we gotta pursue excellence. I said, well, break that down for me. He's like, pursuing excellence just means, hey, you're doing everything the best way you can to the best of your ability. And tomorrow you do it again. And if you keep doing that, tomorrow will be better than today. And today was better than yesterday. So just keep pursuing excellence. When you pursue excellence, you're pursuing the throne of God every time. And for me, I'm talking about a burden that was eased and a weight that was lifted. So, and that's also allowed me, and I'm getting to one of the points that you talk about, also allows me to approach the difficult conversations, right? But you mentioned in here, avoid the comfort-based decisions. And I think I get what you're saying there is not to make the easy choice, right? Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, I mean, we consider, and we came up with this principle in Ramadi, and it really stemmed from, if we were going to get killed by Al-Qaeda or a national insurgent, we wanted them to beat us. We didn't want to beat ourselves because we did something stupid to make our comfort level easier. Mm. You know, so we say a comfort-based decision is anything that eases your comfort at the expense of accomplishing the mission. And wow, one of the toughest story we tell in all the book, and we debated whether we were going to tell it or not, involved a platoon within our company that was stationed at what's called an entry checkpoint. And in Ramadi, it was sandwiched in between two bodies of water, the Euphrates River and the Habaniya Canal. And to get into the city, you had to cross a bridge to go over the Euphrates. And we had a checkpoint there. And the Iraqi police would search. It's very similar to a way station on the interstate. Cars would deviate, they'd get pulled over, and they'd get searched by the Iraqi police to see if they were carrying weapons, explosives, cash, whatever. And we put a platoon over there to monitor it. And it seemed very, very basic, right? It's like the easiest mission in the world. Hey, just sit in this building and occasionally go outside and see if the Iraqi police are doing their jobs. But the problem is, it was 120 degrees. There's no air conditioning in this building. Even the refrigerator didn't have enough power to work because the generator was so small. And ultimately it was so uncomfortable, so miserable. And what happened was, there was an ICE truck that started appearing every morning to go into the city. And the Marines made a comfort-based decision. And from the beginning, we were told, do not establish patterns because Al-Qaeda is watching. So what did the Marines do? Day one, fire team leader took our interpreter, who was a U.S. citizen named Steve from Iraq, started purchasing ice so that the Marines could have cool water. And everything went as planned on day one. Day two, everything went as planned. Day three, same thing. Day four or day five, when they went to purchase ice, that ice truck was not full of ice. It was full of explosives. Mm. And a suicide bomber detonated that, killed a fire team leader, killed our interpreter, and killed 12 Iraqi police, all because of a comfort-based decision. Wow. So we talk about, you know, we responded, my company gunnery sergeant and I responded to that. The scene was one of the worst scenes I've ever seen in Ramadi, the carnage. And it's painful to tell people that story. But every day in our lives, you know, we all, me included, we all make comfort-based decisions. We make easier choices where we shouldn't. And we have to minimize those decisions. And, you know, I never want to make stupid decisions out of comfort. And that's one of the lessons that we learned from Ramadi. And we learned it a very, very tough way.
What's, as a former Marine and, you know, writing this book, what's some things from that that you've been able to take from your, time in the military to lead your family? I mean, what's some things you would tell other men, say, hey, here's some things that we should look at when leading our families, especially with the way everything is in our current day.
Well, I think everything that we write about, it's applicable to any endeavor it's applicable to everything. So this book wasn't written to just the business person. It wasn't written to just the basketball coach. It wasn't written to just the person that, you know, a minister that runs a church. I think these are principles that we can all live by. I mean, I think ultimately, I've already mentioned this, but it goes back to core values, right? Like, yeah. If I had to boil everything down to the most important things that we discuss in the book, is we stress core values over everything. And for me, that's putting God and Christ first in our lives. The second thing I would say is do everything for a reason. Make sure you're thinking logically, thinking critically. And then the blunt and direct communication, I just don't see that almost anywhere in society today, to where you just have honest conversations with people. Yeah. You've got to do it in a respectful manner. They've got to know that you're coming from a place of love. And, you know, I was talking to my kids go to a Veritas school, and I was talking to some of the parents right before school started, talking about raising your kids to be Marines. And some of the push points, it's a Christian school, and some of the push points that I gave them, I talked about work ethic. Mm. You know, I think Christians need to get lit up a little for striving for great work ethic.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, overall, if I was to be really honest of who were the worst Marines, who are our worst employees at Lima One Capital? It was Christians. And the reason that was because they came up with excuses as to why they didn't need to work as hard as everyone else. And usually it went something like this. Hey, I know you want me here till 5, but I'm a Christian and I'm trying to be a really good father. And I need special treatment to get off at 4. But all these other people over here, they're not Christians, so they don't need to be good fathers, so they can stay here and work till 5. And, you know, I think that's wrong. I would always tell those employees the story of Paul. You know, Paul's trying to spread the gospel throughout the world to all the Gentiles.
Yeah.
And not only did he had to endure all the beatings, the stonings, everything he went through, he was also providing for himself the entire time by being a tent maker. And I think there are seasons of life where people have to work really, really hard. They have to work a lot of hours to support their family, or maybe, you know, like, you know, maybe they're not married yet and they still have to work really hard. But I think work ethic is a really, really serious topic for Christians to discuss. And I think the other one is the blunt communication. I think Christians right now, we all struggle with what we're seeing in the world, but I think we have to have perspective that it's nothing worse than what we saw with Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
What Paul talked about to the Corinthians, you know, and I think this is just a pattern of a fallen world. But I think when we're talking about these issues, we have to make sure the other side understands that we're doing this out of love and respect as opposed to self-righteousness. And I think to get political, one of the issues that I see this most prevalent is the abortion debate. I mean, no one is more pro-life than me, but I think when we're talking about this issue, we have to talk and show that we actually care and love for the moms that are wanting the abortions. And we have to say, hey, the reason we're pro-life is because we really believe that this is best for the child and this is best for the mother.
Yeah.
Not, hey, you're breaking this rule, you're evil, and this very self-righteous view. And I think we'll be much more effective in changing hearts and minds when we're going about discussing these tough issues.
Well, I think even in that respect, it's you know, because having discussions with people who are pro-choice, you know, it also gets brought up about, well, what do you do with them after they are born? Then what? It's a valid point. I mean, it's the fostering system is, I mean, it's rough.
It certainly doesn't negate the first point, right?
Yeah, it doesn't.
But you definitely have to address the second point of once the child is born, then what? But I also think adoption, there's so many amazing parents out there that can't get pregnant.
There are.
And adoption is just an amazing, amazing option for all of these ladies.
So I agree, but unless it's recently changed, adoption, man, it's difficult here in the U.S. to do. It's difficult. It's super expensive.
Yeah.
Not saying you can't put a price on a child, but I mean, you look at, you know, children getting adopted from third world countries, and hey, yeah, I agree, they need love too. But then the question is asked, well, why don't they adopt here in the U.S.? Well, I mean, there's a lot more red tape. It's a lot higher price tag to adopt here in the U.S. than it is just to get a child from a third world country.
Yeah.
And it's sad. Because we have so many children in our foster care who need a loving home. Staying on pop. So I was also a political science major. I don't do anything with politics. So
I was going to say, yeah, you're now a musician. I'm now in finance. So we can all see what the political science degree is initially worth, right?
The only person I know personally that has done anything with their political science degree is my brother, who went for secondary education, taught high school government for years, became an assistant principal, then became principal at York High School, and now he's a principal at St. James, down at the beach. So only person I know that's actually doing something with their with their political degree. But that being said, and I don't know how connected you are still to politics, but I'm going to ask, you know, what's next for America? I mean,
Well, my dad passed away in 2013, but I think we had some dark times, you know, prior to 2013. I was probably down with some of the protests of Iraq, even though I don't think the Iraq war was necessary or should have been conducted, but some of the people that protested it in the manner in which they protested really reminded me of what I had read up on or seen about the 60s. And my dad said, hey, you just got to be encouraged that God has a plan. And if you had lived through the 60s, this wasn't nearly as bad as the 60s. And everything's cyclical. And what he stressed was for every Jimmy Carter, there's another Reagan. And I don't think it's one for one anymore. But I do think, we've just got to get some better people in office. And it's not all about politicians either, right? I mean, one of the reasons we wrote the book was we just have a deficiency of leadership in every aspect of society.
Do you think we have a future Reagan currently? Reagan-esque?
I'm not saying we have a Reagan that's running right now, but I am convinced that out of 350 million people,
sure,
there are Reagans out there. So we need to find them. We need to convince them to run. We need quality people running for school board. We need quality people running for senator, president, county council.
Yeah.
We need quality people coaching teams that have our kids in them. We need great principals.
Great teachers.
Great ministers. I mean, there are so many leadership positions out there, and we've just got to have people stepping up with a servant attitude, servant heart, and serving the people that they're leading rather than serving themselves.
Jesus looked at his 12 and said, to be like me, you have to be a slave to all. So, one last thing, as we're wrapping up, if there's one thing that you would have to tell someone to encourage them, whether it's chasing their dreams, whether it's encourage them in their faith, what's something that you would tell them?
That's a tough question. You could have given me that on this morning when we talked. I think I would tell them that, I think back to Jeremiah, that God has a plan for you and it's a good plan. And then I would supplement that probably with life is hard regardless.
Yeah.
And you got to show grit, you got to show heart, but ultimately, it's not about the earthly pleasures, the earthly pursuits. It's about serving God and his purpose. And I told everyone after the campaign, it's easy to say, God's got a plan for me and I believe in it, when everything is working out well,
yeah,
right? Hey, when my plan aligns perfectly with God's plan, I'm 100% on board for God's plan, right? But in 2018, I was shocked that I lost the governorship, lost by 3 points because the president of the United States comes down and endorses the other guy. But I said, the true test of someone's faith is, are you going to believe in God's plan when it doesn't align with yours? So I think that's the challenge for all of us, because life is hard. It's not going to go as planned, but we got to just keep in mind that he has a plan for us and it's all going to work out.
Any chance we ever get another John Warren run?
We'll see what happens in the future.
Hey, well,
I love the country. I love the state. I think we need better leaders, and we'll see what happens.
Well, Esther 4:14 says you were born for such a time as this. So, it reminded me I recalled that whenever you talk about what your dad said, and it kind of related to what my dad told me about raising kids nowadays. He said, I can never raise kids. I could have never raised kids in today's society, but you were created for such a time as this. So
it reminds me of Isaiah. I don't remember the actual verse, but it's, and he said, who should I send? Send me, O Lord.
Yeah.
So I think we all got to, leaders got to step up and say, send me, O Lord.
That's good. Well, John, Mr. Warren, where can people get your book from? And,
So the book's called Lead Like a Marine. You can get it at Amazon. It's on Audible. HarperCollins published it. So I think Walmart, Target, Barnes & Noble. Everyone should have it. So,
and if people want to, you know, keep up with you and keep up with your co-author, leadlikeamarine.com, I think.
You can go to leadlikeamarine.com.
They can, I'm assuming. I follow you on Twitter and everything. So.
I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn as well. Too way too many things to try to keep up with, but I'm on all of them.
Very nice. Well, John, we We appreciate you joining us tonight, guys. As always, check out Revolution Nutrition in Camden, South Carolina, the heart of Dustbin, where they offer healthy protein shakes, iced coffees, energizing herbal teas, aloe refreshers, kid-friendly drinks, and positive vibes. If you head on over there and mention Lowdown, you'll get 10% off. As always, we appreciate you guys tuning in. Big thank you to our special guest for this evening, Mr. John Warren. As you heard, you can check out his book. Check out leadlikeamarine.com. Follow him on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever social media he may be part of. And as always, guys, none of this is possible, first and foremost, without our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and second, without you guys. So thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you. We love you. And as always, let's keep it popping.